Lessons from Lane. The day the hurricane was set to hit Oahu, we brought a cross-section of people on our show to talk about how to keep our residents and visitors safe. One of those guests was Dennis Wong, a Sea Grant specialist who co-authored a book on disaster preparedness that includes new guidelines to help determine if your house is strong enough to withstand tropical or hurricane force winds. We invited him back. Wong stresses strengthening your home now.
What a lot of people didn't experience is the wind impact. A lot of people on Oahu think a hurricane can't hit Oahu because it's in the past it's always hit Kauai. But this was a good lesson that shows that we were very fortunate, because if circumstances were a little different, say there wasn't a lot of wind shear, then Lane would have continued north and could have had a tremendous impact on Oahu. We did go to Texas after Hurricane Harvey. We were at Rockport, where Harvey made landfall. We were with the FEMA Building Science Branch. And we did see several blocks. And on those blocks, there would be most of the houses would be damaged or destroyed. And then there would be a few that were totally no damage at all. And it was like there'd be some in between then. And the key difference was the building code that they were built under. The houses that did well, that performed well, had a continuous load path connection that tied the roof to the wall to the foundation, and they had a good protection around the envelope of the house. For example, window protection. So those were the characteristics for the houses that performed well and survived, and that's what we're trying to get people to do with their houses in Hawaii.
When I drove around after the hurricane was supposed to hit Oahu, I saw very few homes that were boarded up with plywood. You said that there's like a dozen ways to be able to protect your windows?
Sure. Plywood is the least expensive and most readily available material, and we did see a lot of people buying plywood before the event, but it's not as simple as it looks, especially if you don't haven't planned for it beforehand or know how to implement it properly, install it properly. So in the handbook, we really cover how to prepare the plywood panels. They need to be pre-cut, pre-labeled, pre-measured, pre-drilled. It may take an hour or an hour and a half to prepare each panel, but once they're prepared, they take 5 minutes to put up on
now,
each window.
You did mention that there are these special storm paddle screws, and I did go to a couple of stores looking for them and didn't find them anywhere.
Okay. Yes. Well, it's hard to find them in the midst of or right after a hurricane or a watch or warning, but they are in some hardware stores. But if you can't find storm panel screws to install the plywood, we also suggest duplex nails. And you put them up on the top left and right corner of your window, and then you attach to the panel, which is already prepared and
pre-drilled,
and it's essentially hung, and then you just put one screw in, and that's your partial installation. And if the system veers away, it's very easy to take down. If the system looks like it's coming in, you put in the rest of the fasteners. The whole idea is you don't want to be carrying this material when there's tropical storm winds in the area. And besides plywood, the homeowner's handbook covers 11 other ways to protect your windows, because plywood's the cheapest. There's also impact-resistant glass, which is very nice and always in place, but it's expensive. And then there's that's the most expensive, the impact-resistant glass. And in between, there are 10 other options. The homeowner really needs to just study what are the best options. They could call contractors, get free quotes, free options, and evaluate the options and find out the best way to protect their window.
You have brought in some hurricane fabric. And yes. how would you install that?
Okay. The fabric is for large or unusually shaped windows. There's clips on the top and bottom of the fabric. The fabric is usually kept in a bag. It's very lightweight. It's actually one person could install it if you're using fabric. And they clip the top of the fabric above the window. You need something to attach above the window and below. Once the attachments are in place, they're always in place. And then when the need comes, you take the fabric out of the bag and install it.
Yeah. Okay. And the whole idea is that you plan ahead and so that these things can be installed very quickly.
Yes, yes. Over the last 10 years, we protected our house with plywood, but actually recently we installed impact-resistant glass. So that is always in place, and it's passed like missile tests. It's gone through. This is what is required in Miami-Dade County in Florida. The bottom line is nothing penetrates the envelope of your house. No wind or rain or debris, because you don't want internal pressurization. Internal pressurization will cause your house to blow up like a balloon, and it'll more likely for the roof to come off. So that's why you want, to have that complete seal. You don't want to open windows on one side, which is a myth. You don't want to use masking tape because the debris will just go right through the masking tape.
So like okay. When you're trying to tape, let's say, under your doors and your windows, that won't work.
Yeah. Usually people tape the window themselves. But the other thing, too, is remember the two things that were key. We saw this in Texas, in Rockport for Hurricane Harvey. And they saw the same thing on Kauai after Iniki, because both times FEMA Building Science Branch sent scientists out to study building performance. And again, the two key things they said were protect the envelope, no breach of the windows, doors, and have a continuous load path. The continuous load path, again, ties the roof to the wall, to the foundation. Probably the weakest part for most houses is, if they don't have a load path, is that roof-to-wall connection. And that's what the hurricane clip is for. And so in the book that we have, there's several different types of hurricane clips to make that roof-to-wall connection, and almost every single-wall house in the state can be retrofitted with a hurricane clip, and it's not that hard to do.
But again, the whole deal is you seal your house.
Yes, you seal the house, so no wind gets in. There's going to be uplift pressure on your roof. It's going to be uplift pressure from the outside, and hopefully your hurricane clips and load path will keep that roof on. But if there's a breach of the envelope, then there's uplift pressure from the outside and from the inside also. And you don't want to double the uplift pressure on the roof. The hurricane clip and the window protection are working in conjunction, and they reinforce each other. Your clips are holding your roof on, and your windows, protection on your windows is protecting your envelope, so there's no internal pressurization.
So it's not going to be like if you live on the South Shore, just board up the windows, where the wind could come in on one side. It's like you got to seal everything up.
Yes, yes. And that's a myth because when there's a hurricane, the wind could come from any direction. If the eye passes over you, it'll change directions. The winds are circulating counterclockwise. If the eye went over you, first the winds would be coming from the east. Then there would be a period of quiet as the eye went over. Then they'd be coming from the west. So people need to protect the entire envelope.
Right. Yeah. You got to be prepared for whatever which way the wind is blowing.
Yeah. One of the key myths, I think, is people think that this may be too hard to do. Think of it like people always improve their kitchen or their bathroom. If you spend one-tenth of that cost to put in hurricane clips, your house will be a lot stronger. And we always tell people, make it strong first, then pretty.
Okay. You also have a table I want to address briefly. It's a dose of reality that if you live in an old house, it really kind of rates, you know, what's good, what's better, and what's best, and what's marginal and unsafe.
It would be unsafe for, like, a strong tropical storm, okay? So, I mean, they're perfectly safe outside of those conditions. The point is every house could be strengthened. So a single-wall house, if you look at that table, and by the way, this table is online. It's they would just Google the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College program, and then on the front page, there's a page for the homeowner's handbook to prepare for natural hazards. When they go to that page, they could download the book. They could download the shelter-in-place table.
So your hope is that people are going to go out and download this thing and take some action.
It's very important for people to prepare because, first of all, we're still in the hurricane season. Secondly, we're in an El Nino watch, which means there's a 70% chance that an El Nino will develop. If it does, it'll probably carry over to hurricane season 2019. The last time we had an El Nino, there were 16 tropical cyclones in the Pacific. That was a record. That was in 2015. And the only reason they missed us, as the National Weather Service person mentioned, is because it was luck. It wasn't any scientific reason they missed us.
Just pure darn luck. And we might run out of luck.
Yeah. It was an El Nino year in 1982 when Hurricane Eva hit, and an El Nino year in 1992 when Iniki hit. 2019 may be an El Nino year. And with, you know, the warming waters, with climate change, you know, these systems may be becoming more frequent. So people really need to do these simple measures just to make their house stronger.
That was Dennis Wong, Sea Grant College specialist, who's on a mission to get Hawaii to invest in protecting your home, your largest investment. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we test your knowledge of aviation history. Over 90 years ago, the first trans-Pacific flight piloted by civilians left the Oakland Airport bound for the Hawaiian Islands. A high-wing monoplane dubbed City of Oakland became airborne after its second takeoff attempt on course for a 26-hour flight. The pilot was 34-year-old Ernest Smith, and his navigator was 29-year-old Emery Bronte, a merchant marine captain. Both airmen had significant concerns leading up to the flight, mainly regarding the plane's ability to remain airborne for the entirety of the journey without running out of fuel and crashing into the Pacific. Those doubts became a reality as the pilots approached the island chain. Smith realized there wasn't enough fuel to make it to Oahu, and the alternative was a crash landing. For today's quiz, can you tell us what island those pilots made an impromptu landing? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Hawaiian Helicopters, with tours on Kauai, Maui, the Big Island, and Oahu, celebrating more than a decade of support for Hawaii Public Radio. bluehawaiian.com.
Junkraft, a noble mission. A decade ago, Marcus Erickson jumped aboard a boat made of plastic bottles to make a Pacific crossing and to make a point about marine debris. What was he thinking? Well, what he thought was a good cause, to draw attention to the garbage patch and to find a solution to the growing marine plastic pollution. He's in Hawaii to appear at a film screening of the documentary of the voyage tonight at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. He reflected on the nerve-wracking trip, as no one knew for sure if the boat would hold together for the trip, but it did. And a decade later, he joins us to tell us he's encouraged and hopeful for the future.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. We sailed from L.A. to Hawaii on a raft made of 15,000 plastic bottles. No motor, just sort of drifting along. It took us 3 months to get there. That was exactly 10 years.
What brought this on? What fired you up to do this?
Well, I'd worked with a fellow named Captain Charles Moore. I was his director of research for his foundation, and he had found the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. So I was working with him, and very quickly I realized that despite the scientific publications that we had done, the public was still really unaware of plastic impacts on the oceans. So we did this stunt to raise awareness, but then to begin a new organization called the Five Gyres Institute, which we began because there was no one going south of the equator. There was no one going to western Pacific or eastern Atlantic on the north side. So there was a lot of uncharted ocean territory to cross. So the Five Gyres Institute, we began the number one question, how much trash is in the world's oceans?
So fast forward, it's been 10 years. What's changed?
What's changed is really global awareness. You know, I had a chance last year to speak at the UN Oceans event at the UN building in New York just recently at the Southeast Asia. There was a symposium where 14 countries were speaking about it. It's an international dialogue. The EU is about to ban single-use plastics. Across the United States, we're seeing bag bans. So in the last 10 years has been the growth of an international movement get a handle on this plastic pollution problem.
And we're hearing a lot about the plastic straws.
Yes, finally.
I mean, finally.
I call those the escape artists. Plastic bags, straws, polystyrene, like those lunch clamshells you get, styrofoam cups and plates, cup lids. The single-use throwaway packaging is what's clogging our oceans, especially in the nearshore environment. To see those now being questioned, like, do we really need this straw? As people understand that the full life cycle of a straw causes a lot of harm to our oceans, that people are saying, okay, we don't really need this. How can we replace the service a straw provides? And we're seeing people go paper or people go without, and it works.
Just the other day, too, we heard about contact lenses.
Yes, I mean, that's one example. I really haven't thought much about that. It's one example of a single-use throwaway product. But we don't see many of those, you know, littering our beaches. Now, I would guess that those do get flushed. You know, they wash down sinks and down toilets. And I know in sewage treatment we find things, everything from microbeads to, you know, tampon applicators and other small things, plastic toothpicks and Q-tips that get flushed. On the beaches, it's largely consumer plastics, single-use. Often thin film packaging, potato chip bags, single-use plastic bags and straws. So, you know, I guess when you point to contact lenses, I'm thinking all of the possible avenues for plastic to enter our environment through these single-use applications.
And I'm just thinking, too, of what the fish are consuming.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. When you go where the fish are, when you go out to the middle of the ocean, what we find is mostly fishing gear. First of all, it's designed to last, you know, it's much longer than a styrofoam cup might. So when we did our surveys, and I've crossed the Pacific about four times now, we always find a lot of fishing gear. And almost every report from my colleagues, other scientists, they'll say at least half are fishing nets. The other half are mostly fishing buoys and random bits of line and little floats, and fishing crates for holding fish and buckets. What's amazing is in the middle of the ocean, I don't find the plastic bags and the cups and the straws. I do find lots of those the nearshore environment. So somewhere between, you know, Hawaii's coastline and the middle of the Pacific gyre, something happens to the plastic bags and the straws. When I do find them, they've been bitten like crazy by fish. They're shredded by marine life nibbling on them. So my suspicion is that these single-use plastics are becoming microplastics very quickly when they leave our shorelines, from the sun breaking them down and the fish tearing them apart.
I know when we have covered beach cleanups, you know, we do see a lot of the fishing buoys and the plastics off of Japanese ships. It really does make you think about how much there is that's out there in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, when we published our first estimate, about 3 years ago, we published the first estimate of all plastics in all oceans. And that number was about 270,000 tons from 5.25 trillion particles. And most of that, more than 90%, is all microplastics, smaller than a grain of rice. So in the oceans, it's really, by count, it's the small stuff. It's just everywhere. And I like to say it's akin to a smog of microplastics over oceans, kind of like the smog of smoke over big cities. There's a smog of plastics covering our oceans. So when you go walk on the beach there in Oahu or on the Big Island, any of the Hawaiian islands, you will find a little trail of small plastic particles right along the high tide line. That's that smog of the sea getting kicked back on shoreline.
So as you mark this anniversary, what's your hope?
My hope this anniversary, I mean, it has been 10 years, an amazing 10 years since we landed our junk raft on Oahu. I can tell you, I think we set a record for the first airplane to float across the ocean. At that point, I mean, I remember Hawaii was considering, you know, plastic bag bans, looking at styrofoam and straws. Now, 10 years later, Hawaii is a leader. Hawaii as a state was the first to really ban plastic bags. County by county, island by island, you ban plastic bags first. California is next. Other states are following. So when I look back on these 10 years, I really feel optimistic now. I wouldn't have said that 10 years ago, standing there in Waikiki and having just arrived. But now, I'll be there tomorrow, and I'll stay on that same beach in the same spot in Waikiki, and I can put a smile on my face knowing that there are thousands, tens of thousands of people that care, that are doing something about it, at the community level, are looking to zero waste our communities, are looking to end the single-use throwaway habit our culture has. I see change happening, and it makes me full of optimism. So this is where I think people are waking up to the true value of plastics. I mean, I'm not anti-plastics. It's great for electronics in hospitals and for many durable goods like car bumpers and lightweight airplanes, safety equipment. But for the single-use throwaway application, for many other applications, plastic is the wrong material. The full life cycle includes greenhouse gases as sunlight is breaking down plastic, releasing those GHGs. Then you've got a lot of microplastics in the oceans that are absorbing things like pesticides that are floating our oceans. They're absorbing other chemicals, flame retardants. These things stick to plastics in high concentrations. When animals eat them, they're able to desorb those chemicals off the plastics. And then those plastics, they create economic harm, and they create urban blight. They're navigational hazards as big nets. I'm sure you could easily find a sailor or a fisherman there in Hawaii who's had their props tangled by fishing gear. So there is this full life cycle of plastic that goes beyond our consumption of a bag or a bottle. But there is this life cycle that causes more harm than the benefits we get from those products. And that's where the world's waking up.
How are we doing on the companies that actually manufacture these plastics?
Well, that's where it gets really challenging, because of course these companies, they want to stay in business, and they've enjoyed a 4-6% growth rate every year since the 1950s. That's a tremendous profit, and they're not going to let go of that very easily. What we're asking them to do, what the industry to do, is to embrace what we call a circular economy. So what that means, it's contrast to linear. The linear economy means that we make stuff, We break stuff, and then we burn or we bury it. That's been the linear model since I was a kid. I grew up in Louisiana, where I remember there was an incinerator near my house. I would see trash go from the store where we bought it to my house to the garbage can to the incinerator, burned, and a puff of smoke in the sky. That's a linear economy. Recycling in our country, unfortunately, in the United States, it doesn't work. We recycle less than 10% of the plastic we make. If we want to embrace a circular economy, which means things come back to the producer, they come back into the system of reuse, then we have to design things with that in mind. With the design for recycling, design for easily dismantling a product, design for repairing and reusing the things that we buy. And that is where we work with companies. And we work with companies that understand and embrace the new business model of the circular economy. Great companies like Patagonia, lots of surf companies are embracing this philosophy. We're seeing companies, look at Lush Cosmetics, for example, are saying, okay, if we're going to make something, we got to make sure it doesn't cause harm, and the materials that we produce, we want to get them back in our hands so we can do something with them.
When you were out at sea for 88 days, was there any one thing you were struck by?
That's a big question, because I spent 88 days thinking about, you know, making sure we got to Oahu safely. My co-navigator, Joel Pascal, he used to live there in Hawaii for a good 10, 15 years. He's a good sailor, so if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have made it all the way to Oahu.
Were you just worried? Were you worried that the raft wouldn't hold up?
Of course, I knew that if we missed Oahu, that we were headed for Japan, and I don't think we'd make it intact. The raft was constantly breaking down. You know, the ocean loves to tear things apart. The ocean loves to take things that are moving, you know, to hinges and nuts and bolts, and just rust them, oxidize them, and break them. The ocean doesn't have much mercy on boats. So a homemade raft where you got a bunch of 15,000 plastic bottles floating in an airplane, it's all tied together, constantly cracking. But, you know, I had some beautiful moments. I can remember one moment halfway across, just thinking, this is going to be a long trip. We're going to run out of food. I remember at like 2 o'clock in the morning, a storm just passed over me, and it soaked me to the bone. And it was a pretty intense storm. We dropped the sails, and the wind was spinning us around, and the storm passed. Pulled up the sails. The moon was behind me. The clouds were in front of me, and I saw a rainbow. It was in shades of gray. It was a moonbow. And it almost brought tears to my eyes. It was just me. Joel was asleep. It was just me and the ocean enjoying this moment, this beauty. And I'll never forget it. And other moment was I remember watching animals interact, watching frigate birds. They have a big red pouch under their bill and their black feathers hovering above the ocean, and watching flying fish being chased out of the waves by mahi-mahi. When the flying fish would jump out, the birds would catch them. They're sorry for the flying fish, but to watch this spectacle of life before me, I've never seen anywhere else.
And that was a taste of what you'll hear tonight at a screening of a documentary about the 88 Days at Sea on a Junk Raft. We were talking with Marcus Erickson, who made the Pacific Crossing on a plastic bottle boat. Erickson works with the Five Gyres Institute and continues the effort to find a solution to our global growing plastic pollution problem. The screening tonight will be at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, and it's a Books and Spirits event put on by the University of Hawaii Better Tomorrow Speaker Series and a dozen other different sponsors. Advance registration for the free event is required. Our reality check segment with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat takes a crack at macadamia nuts, a favorite commodity of our island state. Reporter Nick Ruby joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for tuning in.
Hey, so what's bugging these nuts?
Well, the macadamia nut is an interesting nut. It's actually the toughest nut to crack, at least that's what all the scientists tell me. But right now it's under threat from this tiny little insect called the macadamia felted coccid. It's a little bug that came over from Australia, and what it does is it uses its syringe-like mandibles to literally suck the life out of these trees. When they reproduce, they cover the trees, and they look like tiny little white scales. And what they're doing is they're sucking the sap out of the tree, which eventually results in it not producing as many nuts, and it could actually end up killing the entire tree itself if the infestation goes on long enough.
So how come we haven't heard a whole lot about these pests?
Well, the felted coccid is an interesting little critter. It first was discovered on the island in 2005, and as I said, it had come from Australia, like the macadamia tree. And at that time, when it was discovered, it got a little bit of attention. There were some headlines. But, you know, Hawaii, we're used to invasive species threaten most of our native species. It's a huge problem for the island. And I think everybody's familiar with the mongoose, which, of course, has decimated bird populations there. But when the coccid came, the macadamia nut industry didn't make a lot of noise. Their lobbying efforts just weren't that cohesive, which, of course, when you talk to some folks, they'll say that the squeaky wheel the grease, but in this case, they just weren't loud enough. So lawmakers weren't really paying all that much attention so they could give more money to it. Also, the macadamia nut is pretty unique to Hawaii, at least in the United States. So at the federal level, it was hard to get attention in Congress, even though our federal delegation was sort of beating the drum on this to try to get money for research and possible efforts to control this pest.
So they're looking at bringing in another species to curb this?
Right. So it's called biocontrol. And I think the most glaring example of biocontrol gone wrong is again, the mongoose. When sugar barons back in the 1880s brought it to Hawaii to try to kill rats. Now, it's not a fair comparison to say that the biocontrol today looks anything like biocontrol back then. Right now, what is happening to control the coccid, potentially control the coccid, is there's a plan to bring in a tiny little wasp that still doesn't have a name yet because it was newly discovered about 4 years ago.
Okay, so what?
And this wasp lays eggs inside of the coccid, which eventually their larva then hatch and eat it from the inside out, which sounds pretty gross.
Yeah, well, we can only hope that this will do the trick. But appreciate the story, and we'll keep on it. That was reporter Nick Gruby joining us from Washington, D.C. To read his full story on macnuts and the macnut pest, visit civilbeat.org. I Promise. It's a public school started by basketball star LeBron James. Today on The Longview, Neil Milner promises to explain why this novel idea just might work. Morning.
Hi.
So what is this all about, I Promise?
Well, I Promise is about starting a particular school in Akron, Ohio, initially for students who have not done really well, mostly poor students who have not done really well in school. Even when there's been a lot of money put in by private philanthropists, then it started in July with 220 students, lower grades, and over the years it will become much bigger and will include the higher grades also. It started by a grant from LeBron James, but that's just a small part of it. And in a recent article in Atlantic, Aaliyah Wong, who used to write for Honolulu Civil Beat, wrote a piece about what's promising about this. And so it's a very interesting piece because it does show that there are really some attempts here to do what most education reform doesn't do. And that also, if you read between the lines, can see where the problems might be if you see this as a model for change.
And so what's the difference between this kind of a school and a charter school?
Well, the first thing to say is to understand, before we even get that, very quickly, mm-hmm. is to understand how often we try to do educational reform that helps poor kids and how intractable the problem has been, that we know that socioeconomic status is the most important variable in explaining success in the school. To put that in plain English, from birth on, there is a separation of middle-class, college-educated parents' kids from other kinds of kids that involve all kinds of economic and psychological issues. And so this is an attempt to get at it. Often we think about this in terms of charter schools, that is, these independent schools that can do things that have much more independence from the regular system. This is a public school, and one of the things that makes this kind of promising is that it is a public school because for two reasons, as Aaliyah suggests. One reason is that whatever people think about public schools, whatever Betsy DeVos thinks about public schools as being inferior, most kids are going to go to public school. Secondly, and this is maybe the most important distinction, because it's a public school, you're building in the possibilities for this school to be an innovator, a test for public schools generally. That's not true with private and charter schools. No matter how good they are, they're operating outside of the system. Now, there's no reason, no logical reason why you can't use those as reform, but it usually doesn't work that way, partially because charters are seen as rivals. So this thing, for better or for worse, is in the public schools, and it makes it possible to see this as a source of innovation.
So hopefully they can cut through red tape, though.
Well, there is that. We'll get to more of the pitfalls in a second. You're right. You're going to have to deal with the red tape and the educational bureaucracy. But the point is that if most kids are going to go through that anyway, you've got to figure out how to do that. And one of the things that this school has done in planning this, and James has been involved in this kind of thing for a long time. He's not just somebody tossing out money. One of the things that the school has tried to do in the planning process for the school is to involve people, staff and educational bureaucrats at a very early level to get them on board and to get some kind of buy-in. This is very different, and this is another advantage of iPromise. We now have a lot of examples of big-time philanthropists, Mark Zuckerberg being a good idea, of tossing millions and millions of dollars into a school system where the change just fails. And one of the reasons it fails, and again, Aaliyah points this out, is because it's parachuting. Because a lot of times people come in saying, we got the money, we're going to hire people who really know how to do things. And they ignore ignore what the parents want, they ignore other things, and they just simply don't work. This is an inside work by someone propelled not just by James's money, but by his own experiences in the Akron school system.
And then this program looks at the whole child.
Yeah, the whole child is a buzzword, and people have talked about it for a long time. But there's been some research to show that most school systems don't really do that because it's expensive and it's cumbersome. So what this school is trying to do it has a pretty intense curriculum. It's STEM-based, and there's kind of hands-on learning and a lot of that. But it is trying to recognize two very important things, that it's not just about what the child is learning in school. It's about broader things. And it's not just about the child. It's about the family. So within this school and for the teachers also, there's all kinds of other resources, nutritional resources, food, opportunities to deal with the emotional aspect of kids, understanding that you need something in the schools in order to overcome some of the limits of the family. In addition to that, and this is really kind of interesting, there's a family resource center where the family members can do everything from literacy education to study for the GED to things like having a barber shop, learning how to write resumes and so on. So, you know, we tend to think about these things as being, I don't know, soft and easy. But the fact of the matter is that this is consistent with what we know about the relationship between family and education.
And pitfalls then?
Well, here's the first pitfall. The first pitfall really involves the fact that educational reform is very hard, and it's almost a desperate kind of thing. We try one thing and then after another. And so one of the things here, one of the pitfalls is don't be too hopeful about it. You see that that is before you decide that you can make this thing work. You better look at how it's working before you decide to use it as a model. Educational reform tends to be local, and it tends to be very subtle and particularistic if it works. If you look at early childhood education, which one works and which ones don't, it's real hard to find hard and fast variables. It's very much based on the little things that occur in class.
Okay, but it sounds like we got to try something.
Well, it sounds like a really interesting attempt, one of the more interesting attempts. And James is a heavy hitter. It's not just that he's bringing money here. He's got his own experience here. And it's worth watching, but you have to watch it, you have to monitor it, and you have to see just how good it's going to be over time.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Neil.
Sure.
That was Neil Milner on the Longview, and he's talking about I Promise, a public school aimed at rethinking how education is delivered to its students.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we have a couple of companies from the second Mana Up cohort. Mana Up is a retail accelerator with a focus on companies with a Hawaii brand. We'll hear how they build the next generation of Hawaii companies and help them grow their worldwide market. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
Earlier in the show, we asked on which island the first civilian-piloted trans-Pacific flight crash-landed. Leaving Oakland in July of 1927, pilot Ernest Smith and navigator Emery Bronte attempted to fly a Travel Air 5000 high-wing monoplane to our islands. The flight should have covered about 2,200 miles and taken 26 hours and 36 minutes, but they didn't reach their intended destination. After realizing there was not enough fuel to make it to Honolulu, the airmen decided to crash land on Molokai. They brought the plane down near the village of Kanakakai, a mere 60 miles short of their goal, Wheeler Field in Honolulu. Today, if on the Makai side of Highway 450 after mile marker 11, is a sign marking the site of the crash landing of the plane, just in case you were wondering. Both airmen survived the crash. And congratulations to Dean from Pearl City. My man, you got it. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. It is Bondan season, and today we get a lesson in the finer points of the Japanese tradition. HPR's Noe Tanigawa joins us in the studio this morning to walk us through this dance.
Well, you say you haven't been?
No, I haven't.
I know you kind of see them coming up, right, at different points around the community. It is such an amazing phenomenon. And, you know, I've been going since I was a kid, and I got to say I only really got the hang of it last year. So there's something to this whole thing. You know, it's so much fun to see neighborhoods start to change when the churches put that center tower up. It's called the Yagura, and start stringing the lanterns down from the Yagura out. So you see this center, kind of a center tower with lanterns all coming out on the side. And that's kind of the central look for your Bon dance.
I came very close to going to the one over at Temple Valley.
Oh, man, yeah. See, now that's one of the super ones. Yeah, well, they all are in their own way, and it's, you're lucky if you can find some of these temples. I went to the one in Kailua. You can't even see it from the road. It's kind of behind a 7-Eleven, and then you walk in there, and you see the people start streaming in. The lights are all up. And this is worth seeking out. And, in fact, that's where I met Howard Tsukai. So cool. Gosh, Catherine, he's the vice president of Aea Taiheiji Fukushima Ondo Yagura Gumi. And that means they're the Yagura. That's a tower group from the Taiheiji Soto Mission of Aea. And they play the classic dance from Fukushima. Howard is the oldest performing founding member of this group. It started back in 1962. And he's a senior instructor of the drums, the big drum, the flutes, and the singing. And the whole thing is that this is not your reserved, pristine, proper kind of sushi Japanese experience.
Music is so like, it's wild Japanese.
Well, I tell my friends that this is the most fun you're going to have on tonight with your clothes on.
True. How should people come to Bon Dance? You don't care if people are messing
well,
up.
Well, I can't speak for Bon Dances in town, but in the country, you know, you can, as long as you dance, you know, people just join in and, you know, be a part of the happening, I guess. When I was going to school, way back in another life, we went to Bon Dances to find girls.
Yeah, can you imagine? I mean, these Bon Dances used to go until the early morning hours. And you got to picture these happening, Catherine, in those little plantation towns where the Buddhist temples were. I mean, Paia, Pahala, of course, there's Hanapepe, Hakalau. It's these Bon Dances in these little places that are now, that are still with us, really, community things that happen. Mr. Tsukai's group and all of these amazing musicians that do come out to each Bon Dance are all volunteers. And they start their season like in June. They start getting together and practicing. And then they're invited to play at the different Bon Dances wherever they might be. And they play the music and are given a small honorarium to kind of upkeep the things and maybe have a little party at the end of the season. But it's a total volunteer operation that keeps all of these Bon Dances going.
Well, I know that the Bon Dance is really kind of a must-do for the politicians.
Oh, you're right. I mean, and they start early on this. And some of them are good, some of them are not. I mean, I remember seeing Bernard Carvalho at the Jodo Mission Bon Dance 2 years ago. I mean, you know what, you know?
Right, right.
So he's like laying the groundwork. And this is how it is done. You're so right. Every single Bon Dance is known to be different. And all the dances may have the same name, but they're going to be and sound different on the different islands. Let's take a listen here to the song that Mr. Tsukai's group does. They play this when they come on to the Bon Dances across the islands. Listen to the cowbells here, the whistle, the drums. How's that singing, Catherine? I mean, you're gonna, you know, these are people who are, you know, accountants. They live in our community. They're baseball coaches, and they sing like this in their free time. But the whole thing is, this year there's been quite a difference in the sound of the singing. Previously, there's been a couple of women who would sing this, and they would have this halfway sound between a shriek and a yell. And you can just imagine how it just conjures this whole country spirit type of thing, which is what it's really about. It's Obon season is when ancestral spirits come back and visit people, you know, on Earth. And so they're welcomed with this big party. That's the whole idea of it. You know, modern songs have crept their way into the repertoire, though, and some of the modern songs are really great. Listen to this. You can just imagine dancing to this. I mean, there are 5-6 circles of people. You know, it's always the experts closest to the tower, and then people in circles outward wearing the kimono, wearing the yukata, and then maybe just in regular clothes, just dancing along with the whole number. Mr. Tsukai says all the neighbor islands have different traditions that go with it, and a lot of them have to do with food. It's the meat sticks, the makizushi. You can get something called the andadog at some of these places.
Okay.
It's a hot dog with andagi on it. On Kauai, you can get something called the UFO. It's basically sloppy joe in a petite panini press. But, I mean, the whole culture of it is different. Every little community that you go to, and that's part of what makes it so great. You know, we're looking now at the end of the season. Hombushin is going to be the last Bon Dance here on Oahu. That's coming up September 8th. You folks there in Pahala, you have the last Bon Dance on Hawaii Island. Pahala Honganji is going to have their Bon Dance this coming September 1st. So that's coming Saturday. And all the others are done for the year. But, you know, there's still time to get ready for next year.
Right. But it's free.
It's free. You just walk on in. Families do this thing. You see young and old. And I saw politicians of every age at these things. The young politicians cutting their teeth, you know, and really meeting people. I mean, it's a community event that attracts people of all ages and all ethnic groups, I must say. And as you heard Mr. Sukai say, you're welcome to try dancing.
Okay.
I think it'd be a lot more fun, though. And this is my goal for next year. A couple of weeks before each temple has their dance, they usually have practice sessions. So, you know, stick it out and try learning, because there's a certain abandon you can attain when you actually know what to do.
Okay, so bone up on the bone dance before you go.
Good
All right.
going.
Thanks so much, Noe. We've been getting the deeper dive, a real treat, a dive into bone dance with HPR's Noe Tanigawa.
Hi, I'm Chris Hanselman, Executive Director of the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly. We're proud underwriters of Hawaii Public Radio. We can always count on public radio giving us the in-depth look at current events and also telling really excellent community stories.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, Smart Yields, a new app to help farmers get food safety certified. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call our talk back line. Leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.